This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Managing chronic pain. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Medical science is still uncertain after thousands of years about who will develop chronic pain and how to treat it. We'll explain why.
Tips on helping your kid to quit if you find out that he or she is vaping.
In sports, Michigan football coach Jim Harbaugh parlays his pants obsession into an ad campaign.
And how the new TV comedies today trade jokes for existential questions.
Comedy has been evolving in a pretty rapid way. You know, on a parallel track from what we've seen in the drama space, you know, people talk a lot about what happened with Mad Men and The Sopranos and how that changed TV. But a similar thing was happening on the comedy side with shows like 30 Rock, for example, and Community.
Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen on TV humor. He's here in about 20 minutes. More than 5,000 years after the discovery that aches and pains could be healed with gum from poppies, medical science is still uncertain about who will develop chronic pain, how to prevent it, and what to do when it occurs. The reasons the same hit to the body can leave one person with short-term discomfort and another with permanent misery have eluded researchers. More on the complexities from Lenny Bernstein, health and medicine reporter at the Washington Post. Lenny, take us through this.
There's been a lot of interest in chronic pain since the opioid epidemic became so terrible. One of the ways we got here is by prescribing opioids for chronic pain. And so some people have ended up taking them for years and years and years. So a lot of the research into chronic pain is looking at whether the pain itself, the signals that are constantly being sent up into the brain, alter the circuitry, and with some people, make you predisposed to remain in chronic pain.
Man. So that sounds like I think you mentioned like the physical circuitry or the rewiring or something is not detected. So there still actually may be the physical pain, but it also could be purely psychological.
In fact, there are a lot of people who the researchers wonder why they are still feeling pain when their flesh has healed.
Mm.
So you may have surgery. And, you know, after a month or two, the surgical, the incision is better and everything is okay, and yet you continue to feel pain. That shouldn't be. You may have an injury and a low back injury, and everything they can detect in your back seems to be okay, and yet you're still feeling pain.
Wow. We're speaking with Lenny Bernstein, health and medicine reporter at the Washington Post. His piece is called, "For Some with Chronic Pain, the Problem is Not in Their Backs or Knees, but their brains." You open the story with this astonishing anecdote of this woman, 36 years with sickle cell disease, right? And really just can't shake the discomfort. What's going on here?
Sickle cell disease is one of the most painful disorders that medicine knows of. They are in constant pain, and then this constant pain is punctuated with these attacks that send them to the emergency room. That's how bad they hurt. Sickle cell disease is when your red blood cells are distorted. They're not bringing enough oxygen around your body to the cells of the body. So through what is essentially a miracle cure, and I'm not exaggerating, they have wiped out this woman's sickle cell disease and that of a handful of others. And yet, for the last 18 months, she's been feeling pain. Now, it's been declining. So what the researchers are saying is, is it just physical because we're waiting for her red blood cells to reach a level where they're bringing enough oxygen around, or are her brain circuits rewired, or maybe there's an emotional component to this?
50 million adults in the United States. Obviously, that's a large number, but that is a large number of the adult population. I mean, you said too, the National Institutes of Health is getting into this. How are they going to study this?
You know, I'm really glad you brought up that number because I hadn't mentioned it. 50 million people are in chronic pain, and about 20 million are in pain severe enough that it alters their daily lives. Chronic pain worldwide is the worst, the largest health problem we know of when you take all the different kinds together. The NIH wants to come up with a list of markers so that when, say, 10 years from now, somebody goes into surgery, they will go through this checklist. Genetically, is this person prone to chronic pain? No. Good. Socially, do they have any of the social markers for chronic pain? No. Psychologically, does this person have a psychological marker for chronic pain? Oh, yeah, they do. All right, we may need to help this person out with some therapy after the surgery so that they don't become a chronic pain patient.
Thanks, Lenny. Lenny Bernstein, health and science reporter at The Washington Post. 11 minutes now after the hour on this weekend.
Now that Human Resources VP Ashley Campbell has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, she's managing her workforce like a rock star. She even has her own hype song.
I'm the spark before the fire. I'm the power in the train. I
have a really diverse workforce with different hours, skill sets, and pay grades.
Don't stop, I'm the dream and you should know that.
Now we're motivating and engaging the right people every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. As use of electronic cigarettes by middle and high school students has skyrocketed, so has the number of parents unaware that they have nicotine-addicted children. Here are tips for parents worried about their kids and vaping from Jane O'Donnell, health policy reporter at USA Today. Jane, your advice?
Well, my biggest advice would be not to freak out, because the not that it's funny, but it is. We've gotten very worked up over a problem that is linked to vaping, but it's not. The people that are ending up in the hospital with lung illnesses, almost without exception, were also vaping THC. So if your child is vaping nicotine and THC, and they're getting their THC from street dealers, which most kids would have to under age 18 or 21, that's what you need to worry about the most. Vaping nicotine is risky, but not risky like that. It's not sending young people to the hospital, but it is a very difficult substance, nicotine, that is, to get off of.
Kids are secretive, Jane, so what are the signs that your kids are vaping?
Among the things I mentioned in the story were things like getting up from the table a lot, having to run off and excusing themselves. You know, kids might not want to hang around with their parents too much at the dinner table, but an inability to just spend any length of time in the same room, I guess I would say, more than usual. One of the pulmonologists I spoke to said kind of the sneaky, what's the word, like averting their eyes, like looking guilty. That's one of them. Certainly excessive coughing, breathing problems. Like if your kid plays a sport, for example, and then they're getting way more winded than they used to, that's an important sign, because this is, perhaps ironically, very popular among sports teams, even though it really hurts the young people's endurance. And then, of course, you find the device. That's a pretty likely sign.
We're speaking with Jane O'Donnell, health policy reporter at USA Today. Her piece is called, Is My Kid Vaping? If so, what? And how do I help them quit? So what do you do if you find out your kids are addicted to vaping?
Well, I would certainly, the first stop in all cases should be the doctor's office. But what I'm hearing from talking to school nurses is that the pediatricians often don't know what to suggest. This is a new thing, having to get young people off of nicotine. I mean, they're having to go through some pretty serious programs. They're being pulled out of school. They're having to take classes, remotely, having to spend time every day after school at some places in these special kind of cessation programs, they call them. There are medications that are approved for this sort of thing, but none of it's really recommended. None of them were recommended for young people, but of course neither was nicotine. So the risk of your kid being harmed by nicotine replacement therapy, which is generally over the counter, so one of the gums or the patches, is pretty remote. So you really do have to get them off it as soon as you can, and also look at why they're vaping nicotine, if that is, because in many cases it's simply peer pressure, but is it peer pressure that's going to lead to far more dangerous peer pressure? The doctor, the psychiatrist from Hazleton Betty Ford Center that I spoke to said it really is. If your young person is vaping nicotine, particularly at some of the very young ages we're hearing, as young as 12 or 13 in middle school, that if they're hanging around with kids that's going to be bad news. If they're doing that, they're going to be ahead of the curve on all the risky behavior, because even though the kid says everyone's doing it at school, it's everyone in his group, his or her group. It's not everyone. It's really 1 in 5, 1 in 4 kids in high school and middle school tops.
That's a good distinction. Jane O'Donnell, health policy reporter at USA Today. 20 minutes after the hour. On this weekend, glad you're with us. On the TV front, Seinfeld, as you'll recall, was famously about nothing. Today's most innovative half-hour shows are about everything. Like, what does it all mean? Why are we here? What comes after death? As content overload pushes writers to stand out with novel ideas, the half-hour TV format has become a vehicle for more ambitious storytelling. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Forget the canned laugh tracks and dumb jokes on TV comedies. As John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal tells us, new shows have become a vehicle for deep questions and ambitious storytelling. John, why are the 30-minute shows becoming so experimental?
I think the 30-minute space in TV has really become like fertile ground for a lot of ambitious stuff for a couple reasons. One, because it gives viewers a concentrated amount of time to work with. They don't have to devote a lot of attention and time to, a big hour-long drama that gets drawn out. Also, I feel like comedy has been evolving in a pretty rapid way, on a parallel track from what we've seen in the drama space. People talk a lot about what happened with Mad Men and The Sopranos and how that changed TV. But a similar thing was happening on the comedy side with shows like 30 Rock, for example, and Community.
It's true. Religiously, I'm Muslim. But I've always been a big fan of Christmas. And this is the most important Christmas in the history of the universe. I'm assuming that's why we're all stop-motion animated.
I vote we let it go.
These like network shows that really kind of broke open what the idea of a comedy could be. And so that's just been going on a pretty steady line of evolution. So they can do a lot in 30 minutes and also for smaller budget that they can get away with these days. And streaming has also kind of broken things open as well.
I was going to say, the streamers seem to be a little bit more experimental. Has that put pressure on the networks to do the same?
Everything's putting pressure on the networks. They are, kind of in a fight for their own survival. But I think what the networks have learned is that, their bread and butter is really sort of the broad comedy stuff, the more conventional sitcoms that we've seen in the past. I mean, there are definitely some exceptions to that. I mean, one of the most sort of groundbreaking comedies of recent years is The Good Place.
They're never going to call a train to take us to the bad place. They can't. Because we're already here. This is the bad place.
That show about Ted Danson kind of being a demon in the afterlife. So that's really a very ambitious show about sort of ethical issues and how to live a good life. And that's on NBC. But I think other than that, that's sort of an outlier. Most of the really kind of envelope-pushing stuff is happening in streaming.
We're speaking with John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal. John, give us some more examples of some of the shows and maybe some of the wackier plots that they have.
Well, and the other thing, too, is to remember that a lot of these can't even really be comedies anymore. There's kind of this, gray area between drama and comedy that's happening in a half hour. And a show like Russian Doll on Netflix is really a great example of that. This show, Natasha Lyonne is the star and co-creator of the show, and this young New York woman who finds herself reliving the same night over and over and over again, and happened to be the night where she dies. So we see her death in multiple different ways, happening in the same night. So it's kind of a Groundhog Day effect, but with, you know, some of the heavier issues that are getting asked there. It's certainly funny in a lot of places too, but it's also like, pretty tragic and sad series. So they cover a lot of ground and go through a lot of different tones, and can do things that, you know, wouldn't really be feasible in the days of the half-hour sitcom years ago.
So, John, are some of the plots more dark comedies with kind of jokes that aren't like ha-ha?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Russian Doll would certainly fit into that. One of the shows I wrote about is a show called Undone, and it's on Amazon. And that's from the creators of BoJack Horseman, which is on Netflix show, which also has been, you know, really groundbreaking. And it's a, you know, it's an animated adult series about a talking horse and a Hollywood populated by talking animals. So it sounds like silly, but it's actually pretty deep and pretty heavy in the stuff that it addresses, you know, including issues of depression and substance abuse and, you know, sort of existential angst, especially as the show has evolved. So the creators of that show, or the producers of that show, have made this show for Amazon called Undone, which, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to call it a comedy. I mean, there's certainly funny moments, and one of the characters, the lead character, Alma, is really, you know, caustic and funny. But it's a show about sort of perception and reality and, you know, what happens when this young woman gets in a car crash and begins to kind of converse with her late father, who believes he's been murdered. And so she can learn to manipulate time and go back and solve his murder. So, you know, you call that a sitcom? You know, far from it. But something about that half-hour space keeps it in the mindset of a comedy or in the same kind of industry categorization as a comedy. So we're kind of trained to think about these shows in the amount of time they take up on the schedule, even if they don't necessarily fit into the usual formulas.
John, are we as audiences demanding more?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, I think that's one thing that you keep hearing from these producers and writers is that, you know, the audience, broadly speaking, has seen so much. You know, we've watched the evolution of TV mostly before our eyes, and even younger generations have, you know, grown up watching these shows on streaming, shows like The Office and Parks and Recreation, which, you know, in some ways are pretty groundbreaking in their own way as these kind of mockumentaries.
Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Your favorite Netflix show gets canceled before the second season. You draw last pick in your fantasy football draft. You're roused from sleep by the construction outside your window the one day you can sleep in. We can't change those things, but ClearBank is changing one unfair thing: how hard it is to get fundraising as an entrepreneur. They know it's scary to put your house up as collateral for a bank loan, and how scary and time-consuming it can be pitching investors, not to mention giving up pieces of your company if the investor likes it. ClearBank believes that fundraising can be easy. ClearBank has created a new way for founders to raise money without tapping into their personal resources. They can fund you anywhere from $10,000 to $10 million in a single day. All you need to do is fill out their 20-minute term sheet to get started. ClearBank works with e-commerce companies, SaaS companies, and yes, mobile apps too. They funded thousands of entrepreneurs and are on track to invest over $1 billion this year. As a special gift to our listeners, qualifying companies that get approved by ClearBank will get $1,000 of additional capital. To sign up, visit clearbank.com/Gordon. That's clearbank.com/Gordon. ClearBank, stop pitching and get back to doing what you love, growing your business. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, can political news make you physically ill? Also, achieving playoff baseball without breaking the payroll bank. And University of Michigan football coach Jim Harbaugh parlays his pants obsession into an ad campaign. That story in about 20 minutes. A new study published in the journal PLOS ONE finds that a large number of Americans believe their physical and emotional health have been harmed by too much exposure to turbulent politics. Is this the case for you? If so, what can be done? How to Manage, from Dr. Judith Orloff, board-certified psychiatrist, UCLA psychiatric clinical faculty member and author of the upcoming book, Thriving as an Empath, 365 Days of Self-Care for Sensitive People. Doctor, what are you seeing these days?
I specialize in treating sensitive, empathic people, very caring people, and empaths who tend to be emotional sponges who can take on the stress of the world. And what I'm seeing is that my patients and so many people are exhausted, burn out, have various aches and pains, are feeling depressed or anxious and helpless because of the news cycle and the stress in the world, and they don't have skills to come back to themselves and build their energy. So that's why I wrote Thriving as an Empath, to give people 365 days of self-care strategies to get us through these difficult times.
Oh, so people, are they getting physically ill, and that's being triggered by the inability to mentally cope with this news cycle?
Oh, it's horrible, yes, especially for sensitive people who want to help, and they care so much about everybody and everything, and they just see, you know, horror stories every day on the news, and, you know, they just want the world to be a better place. They want the world to be healthy and the planet to be healthy and people to get along, and, you know, we're having such a hard time with that. So my patients are experiencing fatigue, exhaustion, depression, overwhelm, irritability with their kids, irritability with coworkers, because they just haven't learned how to deal with this level of stress. Because we're being hit with a gigantic level of stress now, I think more than in my lifetime that I've experienced. And so that's why we all need special self-care tools in order to breathe, to center ourselves, to meditate, to go out in nature, to know if you're picking up someone else's stress and dispel it. You know, how do you know if it's your emotion or somebody else's? Sensitive people often struggle with that. You know, how do you know? And so, you know, you learn how to differentiate, and so you can have the highest energy possible. What you don't want to do is just get depressed and anxious and give up.
We're speaking with Dr. Judith Orloff, psychiatrist, also a member of the UCLA Psychiatric Clinical Faculty. She's got a new book coming out called Thriving as an Empath. So the folks that are hypersensitive like this, they are impacted by, say, Washington, D.C. politics, as well as something like terrorism around the world or natural disasters?
Everything. Everything. And it's seeing your fellow human beings hurt. You know, you're seeing your fellow human beings angry at each other and fighting constantly, you know, rather than getting along and, you know, listening to the news and having it aggravate your children. You know, this aggravates everybody. It puts them on edge. It makes road rage worse. It's just an aggravating stimulus in the world. And so it's important to recognize that. And to have news fast, to not listen constantly. I know some people are addicted to the news and listen constantly, and that will just agitate you.
What's another self-care tool that you like to use?
I love, you know, really setting clear boundaries with people, knowing that no is a complete sentence, where you have the right to say no. No, I'm sorry, I don't feel like going out tonight, but thank you for inviting me. And no, I'm sorry, I can't help you with your project. And saying no in a loving way, but not feeling obliged to help everybody and everything. You know, empaths burn out because they overhelp. And so it's important to be able to set clear boundaries for yourself.
Thanks, Doctor. Dr. Judith Orloff. Again, the book is called Thriving as an Empath. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. How about this for a sobering thought? Much and perhaps most of the money that you'll accumulate for retirement will reflect the raw dollars that you sock away and not the investment returns you earn. How's that, you ask? Here to explain is Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, what do you have here?
We look at our retirement portfolio, we think about how to make it grow, and we focus endlessly on our investment strategy. Should we buy index funds? Should we buy actively managed funds? What about this individual stock, that individual stock? You know, how much should we have abroad, and so on and so on. But the fact is, if you run the numbers, which is what I did for this article, what you find is actually is that the key determinant of how much money you have upon retirement is how much you actually socked away. And it's literally how much you socked away. In all likelihood, the stash of money you have upon retirement, more than half of that money will be represented by the raw dollars you put away.
I thought that was interesting, too. So give the example of if your target is, say, $1 million, and if you started with 40 years to go in your work life or just 30.
So if you have 40 years until retirement and you save at a steady rate, roughly 40% of the dollars you have upon retirement will reflect the raw dollars you sock away. If it's only 30 years to retirement, which is probably more likely because many people don't get around to saving when they first enter the workforce, then more than 50% of the dollars that you have upon retirement represent the raw dollars that you sock away. And even that estimate is probably low for this simple reason. You know, as we go through our careers, our incomes tend to climb as we get promotions and pay raises, and also as we get close to retirement, we tend to become much more diligent about saving for retirement. So for most people in the real world, I would think that the percentage of their nest egg that's actually represented by the raw dollars they sock away is probably well north of 50%.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. His most recent column is called Show Me the Money. How about the actual investment choices that you make? I thought it was interesting that there really didn't seem to be a whopping amount of difference in the end.
Yeah, what I was looked at was, you know, whether you had a stock-heavy portfolio or whether you decided that you would be somewhat more conservative and put more into bonds, and as a consequence, you had somewhat higher or somewhat lower return over the years that you were saving for retirement. And yes, if you invested more in stocks, and as a result, you got a higher average return over those 30 years running into retirement, you would indeed end up with a somewhat larger nest egg. But it didn't make a huge amount of difference. And again, it's for this simple reason, that most of the money you accumulate represents the raw dollars you sock away. I'm not saying you shouldn't invest in the stock market, preferably, you know, buying a well-diversified portfolio, preferably using index funds, but that by itself is really not the crucial decision. The crucial decision is how much are you going to save every month?
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Weekend, This Morning with Gordon Deal podcast is brought to you by Privacy.com. For me, shopping online with Privacy.com is safer. How? By using Privacy.com's virtual credit or debit cards. They protect my identity and bank info when shopping online. Remember the recent theft of financial data of millions of online shoppers from a very large online retailer? Privacy.com's virtual accounts are held to the same security standards as your bank. It's PCI DSS compliant, which makes info online secure with military-grade encryption. Privacy.com can also help you take control of your finances by setting spending limits for when you tend to order too much takeout or by monitoring recurring payments or subscriptions. Head to privacy.com/Gordon. to sign up and start shopping. As a special treat for our listeners, new customers will automatically get $5 to spend on your first purchase. Yep, that's free money to use on any online purchase. Go to privacy.com/GORDON and sign up now.
Swing and a drive to right field and deep. Back at it is Laureano to the wall. And what a way to start a game! Yandy Diaz goes oppo and he gives the Rays a 1-0 lead.
Rays over the A's in the American League wild card game. Meanwhile, the Red Sox and Cubs, the baseball clubs with the biggest payrolls in their respective leagues, both missed the playoffs this year. The Oakland Athletics and Tampa Bay Rays, among the most frugal, both earned a spot in that wild card game. The nature of baseball money from this weekend's Jim Chesko.
To succeed in baseball, a team has to spend lots of money, or does it? To discuss that very topic is the Wall Street Journal's Jared Diamond. Great last name to be writing about baseball, by the way. Welcome, Jared.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I was born for this job. I don't think I could have done anything else.
Absolutely. All right, Jared, the teams with the biggest payrolls here in 2019 are the Boston Red Sox and the Chicago Cubs, and yet they're both sitting home as baseball's postseason gets going. What's the message there?
It's just a continuation of really what we've seen over the last, really now 20 years in baseball, and that while having money, having big financial resources certainly is a big advantage, it certainly doesn't guarantee anything. And we're seeing that again this year, where you look at teams like the Oakland A's in the playoffs again, and perhaps even more amazing, the Tampa Bay Rays, who had the lowest payroll in baseball by quite a big margin.
Yeah, you said it. A very interesting wild card matchup, the A's and the Tampa Bay Rays. Neither of them big spenders, so how do they get there?
With the A's at this point, I don't think anybody should ever be surprised by the success they have. They've been doing this for really a long time now. The book Moneyball, which came out in the early 2000s, the beginning of last decade, was all about how the A's had found a way to game the system and win despite having little money. This is actually the 10th time Oakland is in the postseason this century, since 2000, which is incredible considering what they've done. But really, the Rays might even be more impressive. They only spent about $60 million in players this year. And by comparison, league average is closer to $135 million, $130 million. Somewhere in there, which means the Rays are far 50% plus, 55% lower than league average. And that just does not happen. Teams make it with small payrolls. That happens. But to be this far below league average and to be this good, it's remarkable. And it's a testament to the front office and their ingenuity in putting this team together.
Yeah, it is a team in a small market, Tampa, St. Pete, with a crappy ballpark, let's be honest, and the low payroll. So what is the secret to their success?
Well, there's really two things. One is just ingenuity. The Rays, as a result of their tiny payroll, have realized that if they're going to win, they have to do things differently. They cannot compete with the Yankees and the Red Sox or in their division, trying to win the same way the Yankees and Red Sox win. They will lose every single time. So instead, the Rays have been at the forefront of innovation in how baseball is played. You go back to when they were in the World Series back in 2008, into the early part of this decade, they were shifting their defenders, the defensive shift, when that was not part of baseball at all, and they were doing it for seemingly every single batter. Now that's a ubiquitous practice in baseball. Everybody is sort of a proponent of the infield shift. Last season, we saw the Rays to pioneer this concept of the opener and bullpen days, the idea of eschewing starting pitchers and going with just a parade of relievers. And people mocked them. People said that could never work. And it did work. The Rays won 90 games last year. They've won 96 games this year.
That's this weekend's Jim Chesko with Wall Street Journal baseball writer Jared Diamond. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. It's no secret that the University of Michigan football coach Jim Harbaugh likes his pants, specifically crisp, wrinkle-free khakis. Now Downy, the fabric softener, is out with a funny campaign related to Harbaugh's love of pants. CranesDetroit.com wrote about it. The ad features a mythical laundry assistant named Josh, who commits to keeping Harbaugh's khakis wrinkle-free all season with new Downy Wrinkle Guard.
I don't do sloppy, Josh. Do you think you can keep these khakis wrinkle-free all season?
I won't let you down, Coach Harbaugh.
Harbaugh plays his trademark humorless self, and Josh is dogged in his pursuit of khaki crispness as he follows the coach from field to vending machine in order to monitor quality control. He even monitors the khakis' game-time performance in a film room in one spot. Following a humiliating defeat last month to Wisconsin, some Michigan fans have been rooting for Josh's season-long commitment to be cut short by Harbaugh's firing. And YouTube commenters have been harsh toward the coach, even if positive on balance about the ads. One wrote, quote, "If only Harbaugh worried more about his team winning a quality game rather than his pants." That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.